This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
WNYC Studios is supported by the Natural Resources Defense Council. Using science, the law, and people power, NRDC is committed to confronting the climate crisis, protecting public health, and safeguarding nature. They address the impact of fossil fuels on communities and our environment. They help protect wildlife, public lands, and irreplaceable ecosystems that all living things depend on. They work to enact policies for clean air, clean water, and access to nature for all. You can help NRDC safeguard the Earth for future generations. Visit nrdc.org/WNYC for more information.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The Pulitzer Prize for Public Service, the highest award in journalism, was just recently handed to the reporters who broke the first stories about sexual harassment and Harvey Weinstein's various predations. The allegations they reported, both in the New York Times and the New Yorker, were stunning, and they literally changed the culture. They gave rise to the cultural reckoning that we now refer to as Me Too. And now as we hear the news that Bill Cosby has been found guilty, that sea change is impossible to ignore. The journalists were Jody Kantor and Megan Toohey, and many more at the New York Times, and working separately, of course, Ronan Farrow at the New Yorker. Ronan Farrow joined me on the show in the fall just a couple of weeks after the Weinstein story broke, along with staff writer Alexandra Schwartz. She was covering the Me Too movement, too, as it began rippling through social media. Ronan, I'd like to start with you, and the issue I'd like to begin with is why, in your experience, women don't bring these charges forward to and are silent for so long, and then what happened? Why has this moment happened when the New York Times and the New Yorker were finally able to get women to talk about, in this instance, Harvey Weinstein, and then obviously this has had a kind of gate-opening effect?
This has been a major theme in our reporting, right? Trying to convey the nuances of why it is so hard for sexual assault survivors to speak. And it's a panoply of reasons. It's personal reasons to do with the often paralyzing effect of this kind of trauma on an individual level. The women we've interviewed talk at length about the career fears as well. Some of these concerns are pragmatic. It's a whole range. And I think one of the things that has been an awakening associated with this entire moment is people understanding in a way they didn't before just how hard it is to speak.
Well, what happened when you began your reporting? When you went and you probably started hearing about 3-4 women in the beginning. Obviously, there are many more to come. And when you approached these women, what kind of resistance did you get, or did you get immediate acceptance? What was the process?
A torturous process of many, many months. Almost every source in this story started out off the record and then became an anonymous background source and then went, you know, what we call on the record. And many of those decisions to put their name on this didn't happen until the 11th hour.
So give an example that you can talk about in that way.
Well, you know, a good example is actually the way in which people wavered. This wasn't always linear. Rose McGowan went on the record, showed her face, told her story in agonizing detail, very painfully.
When you were reporting this for NBC initially.
Precisely. Right. An on-camera interview alleging rape. But she then entered a, you know, legal confrontation with Harvey Weinstein and became fearful and for a time wavered, you know. And then after that, she was voluble and talking once again. In another case, Annabella Sciorra, the actress, said, nothing happened. And it was only 7 months later, you know, after our initial piece ran, that she called me and broke down and said, actually, here's what happened. And it turned out that story checked out.
Did she describe to you why initially she decided not to talk at all, why she lied to you in the beginning?
She did. Annabella was one of the people to talk about this fear that I think so many survivors of sexual assault have of being branded, of this being the one thing they're known for the rest of their lives. And, you know, perhaps we're coming to a point in this conversation where it overshadows one less, but I think that's still a very legitimate concern. But, you know, she also talked about the specific fears here of this robust PR machine, a person who is very powerful and very litigious, and as we've chronicled in our reporting, also a really unthinkable, before I reported on this, machine of private investigators and, you know, people operating undercover going after these women. Annabella Sciorra was one of the many women who received a call that she found suspicious from a journalist who turned out to be linked to this whole thing.
But Alex, most women don't face public relations challenges. They don't face private investigators. But some unbelievably high percentage of women who are harassed in the workplace or who face much, even much more serious assaults and rape and all the rest don't report. Just as a baseline understanding, why is that the case?
Well, I think the first thing that we've seen in a number of stories that have come out since Ronan did his reporting is that, first of all, sometimes people do report and very, very little is done. That seems to be quite consistent across industry, across workplace. I mean, we've now seen this in tech. We've now seen this in publishing. It goes on and on. And I think the other part of it is that often people who are in this position, women who are in this position, have to continue to work closely with the men who have harassed them. So it's the barrier to get through is very high.
One of the particularities of this story is that it happened with show business. But as we know, this is one instance of many in many fields. And is it good that this is broken through with a show business moment, or is there a negative side to that, do you think?
Well, I actually think in some ways it's crucial that it broke through in this kind of field, because this is the first example I can really think of where famous women have come forward as a group and said, this happened to me, this was a problem for me, rather than women becoming famous because they came forward with a sexual harassment or assault claim. Nobody knew who Anita Hill was before the Clarence Thomas hearings. Nobody knew. That's what she became known for. In this case, we're dealing with actresses who the public knows, and I also think that the public has a really intimate relationship with Hollywood stars. You see them, you know, for much of your own life. You feel close to them in a certain way. That's what acting is. And I think it was huge to have that, you know, that level of public figure be able to come forward.
To both of you, do you think that fame makes an accuser more credible or in the court of public opinion? Is that somehow transferable then to the rest of society?
I think it can cut both ways, you know. Even, I would say, within that Hollywood community, one of the comments that has stuck with me in this is Annabella Sciorra said, you know, I looked at these other women, Gwyneth Paltrow, Mira Sorvino, and I thought, they're so beautiful, they're so poised, they come from great families, it could have never happened to them.
Hmm.
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons why the ball got rolling to the degree that it has, because you could look at women who are extremely accomplished and say, oh, if this is a problem, I think that's part of what Me Too has been about. If this was a problem for someone like her, then wow, it's not just about me personally. I still have trouble making sense of the degree to which a gate has opened here, but something obviously has happened.
I have to tell you, a lot of men that I know, younger and my age and older too, in this moment have, even though they know themselves to be innocent of anything grotesque or anything on a par of what we've been discussing, they're suddenly sort of doing a sort through their romantic history of what jokes did I tell in, you know, 1998 in the workplace, or there's a sorting through of conscience that I hear about all the time. And the flip side of this, Alex, I wonder what the conversation among women or women you know, not just the office, just your friends, and how that's changed.
I think there's shock. I think it's kind of amazement and shock.
But surely this is not the first time anybody's thought about this or spoken of it.
Oh, no.
What changed?
No. The amazement and shock is the idea that that men are thinking about this. This has not been something that men have had to think about as a group or clearly individually. And I think it is good that men are, as you say, are asking themselves, what did I do? Did I do anything? What should I have done differently? What could I have done differently? I'm not in any way advocating for a mass paranoia or a mass I guess I am advocating for mass reckoning, but not for a sense of personal fear and did I do something and did I screw something up? But these are questions. It cannot just be on women to police this whole situation. It has to be everyone. And so I think just the sense that we may not be in it alone is profound.
Ronan, purely as a matter of journalism, where does this story, if you want to call it a story, go next?
Well, one of the striking things in talking to women about why they wouldn't talk was, you know, they just assumed this would never happen, that it would fall on deaf ears, maybe something would trickle out and he'd be fine, his career would go on. I think now there is a growing body of precedent for you talk about this, it can have an effect on the world. You know, it's going to continue to keep the floodgates open.
Does it make you feel differently about the way you might have thought about Bill Clinton in the 90s?
For me personally, I don't think my view on that has shifted. I think that the inquiries on that were serious and valid. I do think that it has triggered, you know, there's already been a set of hot takes on this spilling out over the internet, a much-needed reassessment of Monica Lewinsky, you know, who I think was badly victimized in the way that was covered.
Who's to be believed automatically in these cases? Are we in danger of overcorrecting, of automatically believing anybody? Should anybody be automatically believed?
I read something the other day that I think gets at it really well. There's a phrase, believe women. Believe women doesn't just mean automatically believe women, the man's word has no weight. I think it's meant as a corrective to what is often the situation, which is often a sense of not believing women as a default. Can you overcorrect? I don't know, but I think trying to correct to some degree is it's past time.
My strong feeling is that we will, for a time, overcorrect. And I think, in a way, that's healthy as a redress for how the conversation has been for so long. The pendulum is swinging furiously now. And I do think, in the long term, it will find equilibrium, but there's going to be a painful period of reassessment before that happens.
When the two of you are following this on social media, what do you make, what do you learn about the conversation in the country about this?
Well, I've been struck by how often this question comes up of sort of why now? That suspicion does still run through this whole conversation. And also,
what's your answer to that?
You know, I think it is that emerging body of precedent that people who didn't feel heard now understand that, oh, there is a mechanism through the media where they can be heard.
But as you know better than anybody, 13 years ago, this magazine tried very, very hard to write a story that included these kinds of charges against Harvey Weinstein, and he was able to fend it off. It couldn't reach print because we didn't have nearly the level of evidence or voices in Canaletta's attempt at this. He wrote a very tough profile of him, of Harvey Weinstein, but it wasn't quite there journalistically.
And I think that is a point of complication, and rightly so, both for women coming forward now and victims of all kinds, and for reporters looking at this. I mean, look, there is—
But Ken tried like hell. I mean, I've never seen anybody work harder on a piece than he did at that time on Harvey Weinstein, and we couldn't get anywhere near what you had probably 6 months ago, 8 months ago.
And as brave as it is, what each survivor has come forward to say, they also struggle with feelings of complicity because of that. You know, did my staying silent over the years allow another person to get attacked?
A question for you both, in terms of the near future at least. What will happen that disappoints you as we move forward, and what will you see as a successful way forward?
I would like to see a situation in which workplaces of all kinds can put in protections for their workers. I mean, everything from Silicon Valley down to hotel housekeeping. And so I will be disappointed if this kind of major public reckoning moment does not lead to that kind of concrete change. I have some hope it can.
I can say on the reporting side of things, look, there is this discomfort that people are grappling with in real time of the court of public opinion versus the court of law. And of course, we would like to have a society in which, you know, criminal claims of this type are fully and fairly heard in the criminal justice system. That is not the reality we live in. And I think that one thing the reporting on this has illustrated is that meticulous investigative reporting can actually interrogate the truth in a really useful way. Now, I think that there is something to the critique that there's now a flood of claims that are not being investigated in that way. That doesn't mean that they're not valid. It means that they merit further interrogation. So I hope that one thing that comes out of this is an understanding of that distinction and the fact that if you report these in the right way, you know, they can be fairly out there in the conversation.
Alex Schwartz, Ronan Farrow, thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Ronan Farrow, who just received the Pulitzer Prize, and The New Yorker's Alexandra Schwartz. I spoke with them in November, and you can read all of their work at newyorker.com.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.